Hello and welcome to Future Majority. I'm Jeff.
And this is Ram, and welcome to our second episode. We had a great run with our first one, a lot of good feedback, and of course, really appreciate everyone who's taken time to listen to it. It means a lot to us, and we are super happy to now get into our second one. And we've just finished taping our interview with Aksa Mien.
What did you think?
It was great. I just love how, you know, no conversation is the same. It was a completely different conversation, and it's really great hearing from someone who's overcome many obstacles throughout her life, coming from an immigrant family, and, you know, growing up in Mississauga, and then, you know, making her way through business school, consulting, and to where she is now. There's a lot to unpack, and it was a lot to hear about.
For sure. I mean, she has one of the, you know, maybe tougher upbringings of anyone I know, and she's made it to the top of the corporate world, and still has retained her humility and empathy, which is great. She's one of those people that you wake up and you're like, hey, I'm feeling like a pretty good person, and you're like, oh yeah, I can be a better person.
Absolutely.
So yeah, a really engaging conversation with her. I love her sort of candidness, I guess, about dealing with the different microaggressions and little hassles and inconveniences or worse of being a Pakistani woman in a lot of white male dominated spaces, McKinsey, HBC, even her school, I guess. I think what did you take out of this?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest takeaways was, you know, having those safe spaces to communicate. And another thing that really stood out to me was how she said, you know, you need to find the right people. You need to interact with those people who are going to have your back. It's not just about, you know, taking whatever comes and whatever falls on your lap. It's very easy to go down that route, but you know, it's really important to not only give value, but also find those right people and continue having those conversations and making this normal as we're all trying.
Yeah, I think she is really generous. And I think that's sort of what I took out of it. She's very generous with her time, with her heart. And, you know, good vibes bring back good vibes. So, all right. Well, without further ado, let's get right into it. Here's the episode 2 of our podcast with Aksa Mien. Thanks for coming to join us today, Aksa. Maybe you can start with an introduction of yourself.
Happy to. So, I feel like probably helpful to share educational background and whatnot, but I actually like to start a little bit before that in mostly the introductions, because I think it plays a big part in my career and how I hope to go forward. So my family immigrated from Pakistan to Canada when I was 7 years old. And it was a tumultuous ride, so to speak. So I grew up in Mississauga, which is just a suburb right outside Toronto. But early on, when I was 11, my mom actually passed away from breast cancer. So there's been a fair amount of different scenarios that I've lived through, in which I think is, you know, as we talk about diversity and diversity of perspective, I think there's a lot of different ways of looking at it. So that was definitely something that had shaped me. You know, my dad, his background from Pakistan didn't really transfer over. He was an engineer, but here he wasn't able to find any applicable jobs. So I've been working since I was 13. I'm pretty sure that was illegal, but, you know, got paid cash at Quiznos, so that was all good. And so I did the International Baccalaureate program in high school, and then I went to Western University to study political science, and then I did my honors in business administration at the Ivy School of Business. After I graduated, I was very lucky to get a full-time offer from McKinsey, which is a large consulting company, for those who might be unfamiliar. I was there for a few years, enjoyed my experience, but wanted to try something just a little bit different, given that that had been my only professional, you know, full-time job. So at the, until that point, and I was very lucky to have a close mentor and a close friend who had just started as the VP of strategy at Hudson's Bay Company, which is a large department store in Canada. So he brought me on his team as the director of strategy, spent a little over a year there. And then I'm a glutton for punishment because I followed him to his next endeavor as he, alongside a few other folks, founded then Growth Partners, which is a growth equity shop from in Toronto. And so currently I'm associated with them, but I'm actually embedded in one of the investments with a company called California Cowboy, where I head up strategy. So that's what I do now.
So that's pretty impressive. If I think maybe that's underplaying it. I mean, from the beginning, it's a very, I mean, just you've overcome a lot of obstacles, I guess. And I wonder what it was like, I guess, from the beginning, like moving here when you were seven. Did you speak English? Did it feel like? I mean, I'm sure it was a big change, but did you start to feel like you fit in pretty quickly, or?
So I think I was quite lucky at coming at the age of seven because I was still a very malleable person. I was in grade two. You know, I feel like it's pretty easy to fit in grade two, with the exception of the fact that I couldn't say the. I always said Leonard pronounced it differently and of course got a little bullied. But I think even a couple of years makes such a big difference at that age, because my older brother, I have one brother, he's 4 years older than myself. And when we came here, I think he had a much more difficult journey because he had to learn French 2 years later. He had been more accustomed, I think, to the Pakistani culture. So it was slightly more difficult to, you know, assimilate. So I think I very much got the easy end of the bargain there. We had gone to a military school in Pakistan because my dad was in the Pakistani military, where I had learned English. I was fluent. I didn't need to go to ESL. So for me, it was, you know, not exactly the barriers right away, but more as I grew and went through the system and learned about the implications of not looking like everybody else, especially in business, where I think being a Pakistani immigrant started to show me the difficulties that I would get from that, if that makes sense.
Can you elaborate a bit on the difficulties?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, given the nature of the podcast, you know, I went to a business school. I then worked in consulting, and now I'm in, I guess, finance. So all of these things are very predominantly male-dominated, and often white male-dominated. And so being a 5'4 Pakistani woman, I stick out like a sore thumb. And that is something that was very clear to me from my first day at Ivy, where I still remember we had our orientation day and the buses drove us to the convention center and then back. And I was waiting to get on a bus and I couldn't see above anyone because everyone was a tall white guy in a suit just surrounding me. And it was a very lonely feeling. And then I've had, you know, anywhere from passive aggressive comments to outright aggressive comments of folks not thinking that I can do the job or thinking I got the offer from McKinsey because I was a diversity hire. So there's been a number of different examples that I think we could go through where it became very clear throughout, you know, really post business school, where I was like, uh-oh, I'm not just one of the guys.
I want to get into that as well, like post-business school, yeah, to your full time, but I also want to kind of just take a slight step back and tell me a bit more about high school to Ivy. So you were in a Mississauga high school, mm-hmm, and then now you're moving to London, Ontario to attend Ivy Business School. How was that like for you in terms of fitting in? Did you feel homesick first year? What were those factors making you feel homesick or any of that? Or you could tell us, I don't want to.
Yeah. No, happy to share. So I think it's actually a little bit helpful for me to elaborate on the you know, context behind going to Western and subsequently Ivy. So as I mentioned, my mom passed away and my dad worked as a truck driver for Chrysler. And then the 2008 recession happened. So My time in high school was a lot of work. Like, I was just working so that I could help pay my way through the school. My brother had gone off to university. And so my decision was, or my, I guess my focus was, get a job that can help me support my family. And so I applied to two schools. I applied to Queens and I applied to Western. And it was because I saw the clearest path to a high paying job through a prestigious business school. And I got into both. And the reason I went to Ivy, candidly, was because I wanted to be able to study something else, because business was not my passion. I would not have thought I would have ended up in business. I actually wanted to be a lawyer for the longest time. And the 2+2 at Ivy allowed me to get some experience in political science before I started my business degree. So in retrospect, I'm incredibly glad that I did that, because Western was a very different experience for me than Ivy was. To me, it's almost two different schools. And I know there's recently been books that folks have written about their experience at Western and how white dominated it is. And honestly, I loved my time at Western. And it's something else that we can maybe even dig into, because it retroactively, I look back on it now, I've been graduated over 5 years, and I now will pick up on like aggressive behavior or like racial aggressive behavior that I experienced there that I didn't even fathom when I was there. And I think there's probably a lot to dig into there, maybe with my therapist, about why that was. But my goal was to get into that school. I did that. And my brother was also at Western. He did a PhD in biochemistry. So for me, it was less being homesick and more just the start of an adventure. And I made some of my lifelong friends there in residence. So for me, the first 2 years were actually not bad at all. I really enjoyed it. And I personally didn't really see as much of the racial component. I think I was ignorant, to be very frank with you. I think I got really lucky. And I don't think I really fully internalized what it meant to, you know, stick out. That more kind of, I felt that at Ivy.
I personally relate to that a lot. I would say even, mm-hmm. I went from being born and raised in Scarborough, Ontario, to moving to Waterloo to attend Wilfrid Laurier. And, you know, my entire name is 23 letters, first name, last name. And from day one at Laurier, not a single person could ever say my name. It was a mouthful. And I relate to the part with you where you say like being ignorant to it. It's because going to university itself is an overwhelming experience. And
yeah,
you know, you had set a goal, you want to get in, you're there now. And you have so many things on your mind. You want to do well at school. You want to be part of the right clubs, and you want to, you know, mesh in, that you're not necessarily thinking about these other things that are happening around you, mm-hmm. Whether it's people mispronouncing your name, whether it's like even sticking out like a sore thumb, you kind of just keep going with it. So it's sometimes not necessarily things that we think about or we even put our energy towards at that time. But like you said, retrospect, you start thinking about it and then you're like, that was happening, I guess.
Yeah. And it's actually, I love the fact that you brought up the name issue where you mentioned yours is 22 letters long. Mine's 8, like 4 letters, first and last name. It's not difficult. It's phonetic. And for the majority of my life, it is constantly mispronounced. And it's really up until, this came up in my previous conversation with Jeff, where it's really honestly in the last like year or two where I've started, I don't even know what the word is, like putting my foot down. I know what it is to say, this is my identity. To mispronounce it and to do that intentionally and repeatedly, which a lot of people do, is to disrespect me as a person. And that's something that I feel like a lot of people don't understand. And I honestly, for the longest time, used to just laugh it off, because it's a lot easier to laugh it off than to be the angry brown girl who's getting pissed that you mispronounced her name yet again. And then you get dismissed. And so I think there's a lot of this gaslighting that happens that's actually quite I wonder if it's unintentional. I hope it's unintentional, but it does happen where people would mispronounce my name and it became a joke that I would be like, oh, it's like an axe. And then you yell out like, ah, axe, ah. And no, it's actually 4 letters. You make the first noise and then you make the last noise. And it's axe. It's not that difficult. And to have someone in multiple interactions mispronounce my name when they're speaking to me in emails where you can't look up, It's I've now actually become quite a stickler about this, and in workplaces, I've had honestly often older white men who will just keep calling me Aqua, and that's just so disrespectful. You know, my name is not yours to in like do with whatever you'd like. It's something that it's a part of my heritage. It's a gift from my parents. It defines who I am. It is my identity. And to disregard that is incredibly disrespectful. And that took me years and years of this happening to be like, actually, no, like, you got to stop that. So I totally understand you there. And there's, I'm sure if I dig deeper, there's probably a lot of things where there was a lot of gaslighting going on that you can't really pretend, you know, like, you can't really be like, hey, you should stop doing that when you're a first year in a new environment, just trying to get a job. Like, it's really difficult.
The name thing is super interesting to me, though, because like Ram, you go by Ram. Do you go by Ram within your family? Is that a natural truncation of your full name?
Yeah, that's a good point. The name thing is very interesting because, so I want to go back to kindergarten, actually. My teacher automatically truncated my name to Pragash with no permission per se. And she had just gone to my parents and said, you know, I think the name's a bit long for the other kids to say. It's best that you take one of the ends of my name. And I mean, at that time, my parents were immigrant, like we were an immigrant family. I just, you know, we were in Canada. They just want the best for us in school. You know, they're not thinking about, no, let's save his identity or nothing. They went ahead and let my teacher kind of truncate my name. And then moving forward, I was Pragash for a long time. So I've had a lot of like identity crisis, to be very honest.
Oh no.
And then my friends started calling me Ram in middle school because a lot of teachers started calling me Ram. And then it was one of my middle school teachers actually who was like, look, you have a chance to like make this right. Like, your identity matters. If you want to be called Ram Pragash, like, keep your name, change your record. You know, your TDSB, like Toronto District School Board record, is Pragash. Like, what is it that you want? And it's something that you should think about. And I'm really grateful to her because that point onwards, I was like, no, like, I'm, this is my name. This is my first name. I'm proud of it. I like it. And I should keep it. And that's when I changed it fully, like, on a record basis. Like, nope, this is my first name. And this is how my birth certificate is. But as I started going to university and applying to jobs, I couldn't help but notice that, or even think to myself, Ram Pragash Saravanabhavan was not being looked at, but Ram Saravanabhavan had a better chance of being looked at from a resume standpoint. And I wouldn't point people out who've told me, but there's people at a professional level who've said, yeah, I think this will look better on your resume on the header if you just put Ram Saravanabhavan instead of putting Ram in brackets, which is them kind of inherently, like, you know, implying to me there that, you know, Ram sounds better. So yeah. I think I'm still going through it. And you'll see my name in brackets sometimes. Like right now, the three of you can see that on Zoom, it's Ram Pragash, but I've put Ram in brackets when I'm in class so that the prof can have a better shot at saying my name. So it's a bit of back and forth, and I totally relate with Axa here, because it's not hard. I mean, like, your name is four letters, and right, it's really about just taking a minute to look at it and read it, and not I'm just
like, the first time, if someone asks me the first time, I'm happy to like help talk you through it. If you worked with me for 5 months and you're calling me Aqua, problem's not with me at this point. Like,
do you find that though, that people are, in 2021 at least, are people like stopping and asking, I don't want to mispronounce your name, how do I say it? Are there more people doing that, do you find, without just jumping into whatever they want?
For sure. And I do also think that it makes a really big difference where you are. And so in my current, you know, the two organizations I'm associated with, California Cowboy Event, no one ever mispronounces my name. I actually am called Axe Money at Event, because they're a bunch of really great guys that apparently that's my nickname, and I'll stick with it. But when in my time at McKinsey, I had many different clients, and you know, that was not that long ago, it was a couple of years ago. And depending on where I was staffed, like which part of the States, because I did a bunch of work in the States, often people don't ask still. they'll just, you know, butcher, and then I'll correct, and then they'll butcher again. So I think for anyone who might be listening, the small act of just, if you don't know how to say it, just kindly asking, it is incredibly important and just does wonders to make someone else feel welcome. Because there are some typically white names that, you know, are now spelled really weirdly, where I would ask if I didn't know it's their identity.
That's interesting. So you were saying how at Ivy you felt maybe so that there was like aggressions or microaggressions. How did you deal with those things, or did you not, because you didn't see them as microaggressions?
To be honest with you, I think it's a combination of some small things that were done, and then a lot of it kind of not exactly taking the time to engage. Like, they obviously make you feel crappy, but there's always that question of like the trade-off. And in IV, and I think going through recruiting, it is a cesspool of anxiety and stress and like, oh my God, I'm sure you guys have experienced that to some degree. And in HBA1, which is like our third year, it gets really toxic because everyone's talking about who has what interview and where. And a lot of these things come up when you're in an inherently competitive situation and there's a limited number of positions for a large number of people. And I think people's very basic, like, you know, I guess like the people lash out against whatever they can, and being of a different ethnicity, being a girl, it's really easy to make those hits and to break someone down because these really easily identifiable differentiators. And so there were some things where, to be honest with you, I didn't really do too much about because I didn't really know what to do. Like, who do you bring that up to? And so it's one of those things where I think in retrospect, I think back to it, and I was just finding friends who also might have experienced something similar, knowing that, you know, you weren't alone, being able to get that support if possible. But I didn't actually really do much about it. And I don't know if I would go back, if I would do anything differently. A lot of my confidence has come from the fact that I've done well in the positions that I've been able to get. And so now I have, I guess, a ground to stand on, which is absolute garbage if you think about it, because what ground did everyone else have to stand on? Like, why was it that I needed to get this ground to have validation? But now I do. So now when someone is has any kind of aggression towards me, I'm a lot more comfortable calling it out and calling it out for what it is, which is like often racial microaggressions. But back then I was just another student. I was a very poor student who was in a lot of debt, who had to take out many loans to get herself through school. And at that point, I prioritized getting a job so I could support my family, pay off my loans. Honestly, standing up against this stuff didn't seem my top priority, which is shitty.
That reminds me of a story. Do you guys know Hassan? I'm going to screw up his name. Hassan Minhaj?
Yeah. Yep.
He's first of all, he also is like, I think, more insisting on people saying his name correctly now, which is interesting. Mm-hmm. But belatedly, right? He didn't do it as much when he was like new on the scene. But he has a great story about his dad and how his dad has a perspective as an immigrant, which is just that there are some crappy things that happen to you as an immigrant, but that's the price you pay. Like, you take these microaggressions, you maybe people talk, you know, behind your back or whatever, but you get to live in America or Canada. And that's, you know, that's just the price to be paid. But the younger generation, like us, is a little more like, we grew up being told that we're all part of an equal society and da 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 da, and we don't really have that same expectation, and we chafe against it a little more quickly or a little more readily. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, I also do think that the price paid for the people that made the decision, like Hassan's dad or my dad, like my mom and dad, I should say, but my dad gave up a whole career, his whole family, to get on a plane and fly to an unknown part of the world, really taking a gamble so that my brother and I could have a better life. And I'll be frank, a lot so that I could have a better life, because the Pakistani society is still one in which marriage at a young age is very much encouraged, if not, and sometimes mandated. So I think for them, these things probably are micro, right? Like for them, they often have faced things that are very severe and aggressive, in a much more like, I think, obvious sense of the word. So I very much could see that. And for my dad, I remember when I was a child, had told me like, this world is man-made, man-oriented, and man-dominated. And especially if you're going into business, you will always be up against a system that was not built for you. And he's like a Pakistani dude, like very like classic guy. And he was probably my like biggest cheerleader ever. But I think for them, they aren't as big, but I think we're demanding more, as we should, because, you know, like we're, especially in Canada right now, is a reconciliation of, you know, who gave someone else the right to be the ones that don't have to deal with it. Like, I'm going to take that right for myself. And so,
yeah. So how has it been navigating you have a lot of experience now navigating sort of majority white worlds, right? First at Ivy, and then you were saying at McKinsey, and I'm sure HBC is probably not as, maybe doesn't reflect the cultural diversity of Canada. So how has that been, and has it changed, and have you changed how you deal with it?
Absolutely. I think one of the things though that has been a big game changer is the scale of organizations I'm working at. So McKinsey obviously is a massive organization, and they are focusing on diversity. I will say there was a lot of effort being done there in order to make sure that they were more, you know, reflective in their hiring practices and who they had. But you don't get that same grace when you go to client sites. And they really did differ. Like, I had a client in Raleigh, North Carolina, and I will forever remember like trying to get breakfast at the hotel, and there's Fox News playing with Trump talking about the Muslim ban. And I have, my first name is the name of a mosque. Like it's a little bit of a fear line. So I think it very much differs, because I now work in an organization that is no more than 10 people big for either one. And they are, again, primarily white dominated, but genuinely open-minded, very like people who are really trying to make that difference. And I think something that really helped me was getting sponsors and mentors that I felt as though genuinely couldn't see that I was not like them, that they were able to see past the fact that we looked very different to the fact that we were fairly similar. And to me, I think having that transition to get to a small organization where people are really welcoming, and I think actually are making a lot of effort to make sure that everybody feels welcome. And I genuinely feel like there's no difference between, you know, how I'm treated because I'm a different skin color or anything. Like, that was huge. And secondly, I think having the supportive mentors that if someone is treating you poorly, that you're able to like have the courage to stand up because someone's going to have your back. And so I've been very fortunate to have found people like that. And in particular, Jeff, you know, Chris Reynolds, who was my first EM at McKinsey, he has been like my biggest sponsor, and he is a large white guy. And he and I have always been good friends, and we've become very close friends, and he's always had my back. And so at HBC, when people would mispronounce my name, sometimes he would turn around and be like, yeah, she'll respond if you call her actual name. And to have somebody else do that for you is just like, oh, it feels so good, because it gets really exhausting to be the one who has to respond to all these things. And now, you know, like Drew was the current CEO of California Cowboy. Like, I've always had very open conversations with him about that when we're trying to recruit, like even the way we more thoughtfully think about how to get talent that is more diverse, which I can get to how difficult that is at senior levels and how that's a whole problem. But I think it's the big thing is, you know, finding places where you're comfortable that people will treat you well, and then having people who will have your back, because no, it's really hard to go through this stuff alone.
Do you in any way feel part of the institution now? Because you've worked at sort of really top white collar companies, and even Chris, who you mentioned, his dad has a long career in Canadian politics. So you've sort of navigated that path. Do you feel like you're part of the institution now, or I don't know, how do you feel about that?
I haven't actually really thought about that. I guess, yeah, I You know, I have been very lucky because I think once you get a name like McKinsey and you have the experience there, it gives you credibility. It is an institution that has a certain reputation, and when you belong to it, you really benefit from having that connection. And so I would say, yeah, I probably am a part of the institution in some ways. And I think in other ways, it's really hard to still not feel like an outsider. Like whenever you look at the partner group and it's, again, mostly white guys. And it is difficult, right? Like it's really difficult to see yourself belonging amongst them. So I feel like there's always going to be, to Rand's earlier point, identity crises happening as you consider all the different like intersections of like maybe I am, but maybe I'm not.
For sure. Do you think it's an advantage to be, I feel like maybe what you're saying is like, you still feel like an outsider, but is there an advantage to that mindset?
I think there can be. I think if bringing an outside perspective and then being willing to stand up for it, like I think if you're able to actually bring in the outside perspective and then frankly have the balls to push it and actually stand behind it and to push for things that will help other quote unquote outsiders also get in, then there is the advantage. For a long time, I didn't feel comfortable doing that, in which case your imposter syndrome goes through the roof because you just will always feel like an outsider. So I think there's something about embracing that identity and then trying to actually use it as an adventure. I think it has to be a very intentional exercise as opposed to something that just happens.
You know, you had mentioned the, when you talked about like your name and those certain instances where you're like, you know what? No, like this is how it's supposed to be said. And here's mm-hmm. this how it's supposed to be. Did you have any defining or aha moments during your career so far where that kind of made you be like, you know what? No, this is how it's supposed to be. And because I feel like as people of color and as a woman, like we all have gone through these kind of aha moments and defining incidents that kind of like make us rethink what is going on around us. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering, as someone who's, you know, been through consulting and of course, you know, even prior to that recruiting from a business school, Are there any moments like that kind of stood out to you that you can remember or speak to?
Yeah, it's interesting. As soon as you started seeing the room, it's like one moment like screaming into my head that I hadn't actually thought about in a long time. So great question. For sure. And it actually happened right towards the end of my time at McKinsey. I was on an engagement in the States. For a large financial institution, and I was playing the role of engagement manager. And of course, that was when I was even younger, and I looked young, and I had a, you know, somewhat high-pitched voice. And so the situation was that we were doing interviews with different client groups in order to do a determination on their digital maturity. And so I still have to speak in somewhat vague terms because we all signed NDAs. And so we were going around to all the different large parts of this organization and speaking with the heads of those parts of the organization. So like SVP level, like very senior, trying to get an understanding of how they had been building their digital maturity so that we could get an understanding of the overall level of the organization. I was relatively new in playing the engagement manager role. And when I was at one of these meetings, it was, you know, at a very fancy, like, you know, high rise tower, just like the classic image that you get of like the consulting lifestyle. And it was a lot of very senior, mostly white men in that meeting. And I was conducting the interview with the SVPs and whatnot. And so with me was a business analyst from my team and the associate partner. So one level above me. And he was a white man, and he had been quite supportive. And as we're going through this interview, I'm the one asking all the questions. I'm the one who's driving the meeting. And the client in question just wouldn't respond to me. Or he would look directly at the AP, the associate partner, whenever he was responding. And just essentially dismissing me. Mm-hmm. And when I tried to ask follow-ups, because it was a large meeting and everyone was trying to talk, which I'm sure we've been in a lot of those, it just happened constantly. And I'm the one who's responsible for this deliverable, and I'm the one who's conducting the meeting. And in moments like that, it's really difficult to not seem quote unquote, like a brat, if you're like, dude, what the hell? Like, obviously you can't say that. And so I wasn't quite sure what to do. And so the next time it happened, because it had been going on for quite some time, it wasn't an accident. The AP, actually, because the client looked directly at him to answer a question and then asked him what he thought. And he said, oh, I think this, but maybe you should tell that to AXA because she's the one running the meeting.
Wow.
And I was just baffled by his like very easy way of doing that. But then because he gave me the mic, they actually listened to me. And so in one way, it was great that he did that. Now the other way, I was like, are you kidding me? Like when we first started all of this, I needed that validation. Like it wasn't just enough that I'd shown up and been the one to do all the work. I needed that stamp of approval. And so that was the moment where I was like, oh boy, like there's, I got to do something differently here. And I've got to start not letting things slide because then it just makes behavior like that seem okay. I hadn't really lived in a long time. So, wow.
No, thanks. For thanks for sharing. That is quite defining actually. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So maybe what advice can you give to people that is maybe actionable for their own careers or supporting people that they, you know, around them that they think are maybe not getting a fair shake?
Yeah. So I would say two very different pieces of advice. For those who are starting on their careers or kind of going through their careers, I think the piece earlier I would reiterate, find people who really support you and people that you really identify with. You know, it's very much a two-way street. And sometimes I think, especially in school, you're a little bit like, I'll take what I can get. Like, well, whoever wants to mentor me, like, great. But it's like dating. I feel like you've got to go find someone who you can add value for, but who's also really going to have your back. Because that's how you're going to build a relationship that's then going to help give you that courage to be able to make the moves and stand up for yourself and get that guidance when you're in a sticky situation. And like I've mentioned, you know, Chris Reynolds is one of the people, of course, I'd have to mention, but I've had the privilege of having so many people who've looked out for me and had my back and, you know, helped just push me and to do more, and couldn't really name all of them on here. So I think find your group, and that can be a lot of different people. Like it can be someone more senior to you, someone who's going to sponsor you. And for those who may not be familiar, very much would encourage you to look up the difference between a sponsor and a mentor and get yourself a sponsor who's going to put their neck on the line for you and actually make things happen. They're just, if not more equally important than mentors. But I also think it's about finding people in your circle who have your back too. And I would be remiss to not talk about the business analyst class I started with at McKinsey, who really shaped me as the person that I am, who always had my back. And like some of my best friends have come from that group. People I'll still reach out to ask, like, is this in my head? How should I deal with this? People that you know you can talk to without any fear of judgment, who have your best interests at heart. And I think as a community, you're then able to make that change. So that's a big one. And then for those who are looking to support, I think trying to educate yourself is a huge one. I'm always happy to educate anyone. I often, you know, very clearly state if anyone has any questions about being a Pakistani immigrant or being, you know, a part of the Muslim world or any questions about the faith, anything like that, I'm always happy to answer those questions. But we have so much knowledge on our fingertips these days. And I think that there's an onus on everybody, not just those who are facing the obstacles, to learn more and to, you know, educate, to open your eyes to the solid, the deep levels that this goes. And I think then being all the values I was kind of describing for what you should be looking for, but being open, being trustworthy, being not judgmental, and not conflating privilege with like not having worked, because that's a big one of like, you can sometimes try to talk to somebody about the difficulties you faced and you often get the response of, well, I worked really hard too. And it's like, yes, but the way you look isn't a constant obstacle to your success. And so I think just doing your own work to figure out what your own privilege was is really critical to be able to support those who maybe haven't had as much.
That's really good input. I think that whole asking people about their experience thing is so underrated. And I think people are sometimes scared to ask, especially if you're of the majority, that you're like, oh, hey, Ram, are you Muslim? Or and they get awkward about it. And but I think if you ever ask from a genuine place, like I've been asked in a genuine way, and I'm always happy to talk about it. And also realize that everybody only has a limited experience. So I don't know what it's like for a Punjabi woman. You don't know what it's like for like a Chinese man. And we both don't know what it's like for a black man, right? So to have that conversation, I think is such an important thing, because you'll find more commonalities than not, you know, everyone feels, you know, I feel like a lot of people feel like they're an outsider. And maybe we are just more tangibly able to like pinpoint things that are like obvious outsider attributes or whatever. Right.
Yeah. 100%. Yeah. I think having, for anyone who knows me, this will come as no surprise, but I'm notorious for talking about very like quote unquote politically incorrect things very early on when I meet people. But I think it's because those taboos harm us. Not talking about our backgrounds or what makes us different, and frankly, what our perspectives are, like that limits us. And I think more often than not, if approaching it in a respectful, you know, open-minded way, you often walk away just like so much richer for it, and you know, in your thoughts and opinions, than if you get too scared to ask about it. And so my partner is a white guy, and maybe he'll tell me to stop talking about it as much, but I've taken it as like my personal mission to educate him. And like, I have so many conversations at dinner parties or when we're out with friends about what it's like to have prejudice. And, you know, that's probably quote unquote not politically correct, but I think that there's a net benefit to actually being able to share that. And then people feel more comfortable sharing something that they may not think is correct to say, you know, but then you can actually discuss it, as opposed to what's happening in the States where people just like shove down all their bad thoughts and then they're told that they're bad people. And all that does is just amplifies it. So I'm all for open, honest communication, just as long as there's respect. And so I'm happy to have that conversation with anyone, anytime. Love to talk. So that's not a problem.
And I'll just retract something I just said. I'm actually not sure, Fran, what your religion is. And so I use that as an example, just as like a, maybe someone looking at you and asking like a quote unquote dumb question. So I apologize if that was taken the wrong way.
No. I know you're just doing an example, of course.
To wrap it up, maybe we can do a topical news item that I haven't talked around about this, but maybe it's too much. But I wonder, because you said about like, what is our own privilege? Mm-hmm. All this news lately about the residential schools, and you know, we have our battles that we fight, but clearly, I mean, that's, we didn't have to deal with that, you know? And we just had Canada Day. I wonder what you think about this whole cancel culture and should we cancel Canada Day? Is it, what are our obligations there as humans, as Canadians?
Yeah, so large question. Just to wrap it up, super quick. there's a couple of different things that I think are important to talk about. First and foremost, it's horrifying. It's horrifying, and it shouldn't be surprising. Like, we know that there was a genocide, or an attempted genocide at least, that was committed as Canada was colonized. And I think right now we're being forced to reckon with the brutal reality of it. But my partner said this, where he's like, it's actually not surprising. We should know, you know, we should have known more. I personally
didn't know much about the residential school thing until recently, you know, I didn't know they existed. I didn't know what they were.
Which is in of itself a travesty.
Right.
That going through the Canadian, I'm not sure if you went to the Canadian school system. I think you did. I did. And I didn't know the extent of it. I knew there was such a thing, but I think there was maybe a paragraph in my history book. And so that in of itself is absolutely messed up.
That's exactly what I told one of my friends. It was just a paragraph in a textbook, and that's as far as it went. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that like is what going to the point of trying to educate ourselves. I've been trying to read more books from the perspectives of Indigenous people, Black people, hearing from them their lived experiences and trying to become smarter on this. But the more, I think it's the start of it. I think they've only gone through a handful of schools, and the death toll I think was like over 1300 already. Mm-hmm. So this is the start of a very long journey. So that in itself, like, I just, number one, it's absolutely horrifying. Number two, I am a proud Canadian. My family came here searching a better life, and the opportunities that I've gotten living in Canada are unparalleled. And so I'm grateful to be here, and I'm grateful to be part of the privileged few that get to live here. I don't think that takes away from trying to recognize that there is a bloody history that this land was built on. And that doesn't actually take away from being a proud Canadian. If anything, to me, being a proud Canadian means that I need to do better about learning about the origins of the land and its peoples. And then trying to push for change and actually doing something to reconcile what's happening now. So many First Nations communities still don't have access to clean water. They wrote out literally the 94 actions of this is what you need to do to make it okay. And they didn't happen. So as someone who wants to be proud of the country that I live in and the country that I represent, which I am, I think it means that we also need to ask that of our leaders to make it a place that we can truly be fully proud of. It's not over. It's not just something that happened in the past. It's not enough that all the countries get colonized. That's intellectually lazy to say. How can we be better to be fully proud of this place? Because I am proud and I want to continue to be more proud. And I think that means educating ourselves, asking our leaders to do better, and genuinely trying to reconcile with the people who have suffered just an immeasurable amount. So I think those things aren't dichotomous. I think it's something that we need to all kind of come to. I didn't really celebrate Canada Day because it didn't seem right. And the more I learned that in the Indigenous community, when a death happens, you mourn as a community. And that's, I think, you know, it's like try putting your money where your mouth is. Mm-hmm. And the thing I would like to address, though, is about cancel culture, right? Because I think it's become a little bit bastardized. I think, again, it's too easy. You don't learn and grow when you cancel somebody. And that is what creates that environment of people not wanting to talk or and learn more and have those conversations because they're terrified that they're going to get absolutely slaughtered if they say the wrong thing. That is not how we learn and grow as a community. And so I think if the intent was that if someone behaves poorly, there's, you know, consequences, I think that's not what it's ended up becoming. It's ended up becoming that everyone's on eggshells trying to not say the wrong thing. And so, yes, there should be consequences if someone's an absolute, you know, terrible person. This was the part you might have had to bleep out if I hadn't used terrible person. But I think that now it's gotten to the point where seeing things like cancel Canada Day, that's just an incendiary expression to try to get a reaction. I'm not trying to cancel anything. I'm trying to, if anything, trying to cancel is just the terrible treatment of our Indigenous peoples. But I think it's actually creating a lack of conversation. It's creating barriers to understanding. So I think we shouldn't, like, when is it that canceling someone has ever actually led to them being like, oh, I should educate myself and figure out why I got canceled? Like, it just causes more harm than negativity. So I'm not a fan of that. I don't like that phrase. And I don't think it actually, I think it's, again, it's a lazy way of trying to talk about a deeply complex issue. And I think it just makes things harder. If anything, it's like, you know what, talk about things the way I like to talk about things the way that it is, where it's like, did I cancel Canada Day? No, I'm a proud Canadian, but I recognize that the day marks the start of colonization and that was really fucked up. And I want to learn more and I want to support my Indigenous neighbors. And that can't be summed up in like a catchy 3-word phrase. And if it can, I'm not clever enough to find it. So I hope that touched on all the many parts of the question.
No, I mean, that's a great sum up. I think I've talked to you a couple of times, and I'm constantly impressed by your, you know, with your upbringing and background. Like, you're still so empathetic, whereas some other people would have easily been like, well, you know, I made it, so anyone could do it kind of thing. And that's, you know, that's not really true.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I just on that note, I think as humans, our ability to be compassionate and empathetic are deep strengths. And especially in the world of business, those things have gotten overlooked. But I think more and more we need to lean into that. And I think I might have quoted it to you where the countries that did the best in responding to the pandemic were typically women-led countries that actually had a intersection of being decisive and strategic and all of the typically masculine traits, but also being compassionate and empathetic. So I think that we should all try to be a little bit more empathetic because it'll probably get us a bit farther.
Well, great. Is there anything you want to add to wrap it up?
No, just thank you guys so much. I think these are exactly the types of conversations that we should be having. And I love the name of the podcast, actually. I didn't know it was called Future Majority, but I think that's lovely. And, you know, looking forward to the day where the tops of the corporations and the governments and everything will look a little bit more like the populations that they're representing or serving. And I think that'll get us to a better world, hopefully.
Great. Great.
Well, thanks for your time.
Love it. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening. CFRC and Queen's University sit on the traditional lands of the Haudenosaunee and Anishinaabe peoples.
Future Majority is supported by the EDII Blue Sky Initiative of Smith School of Business. And we'd also like to acknowledge the Faculty of Engineering and Applied Sciences, as well as CFRC, for their contributions.